Good evening and welcome to this extended Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for June 7th, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis. On today's show, a discussion of whether or not to rebuild the Moscow East City Park stage in a different location in the park. That's coming up after headlines from FSN and the Public News Service, followed by a roundup of regional news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nick Harper. U.S. President Joe Biden has warned that democracy is under threat in a speech marking the 80th anniversary of D-Day. The American leader spoke overlooking the French beaches in Normandy, where Allied soldiers landed in 1944 to fight Nazi forces. In the run-up to the U.S. presidential election in November, Biden is warning that if re-elected, Donald Trump would pose a serious threat to U.S. democracy and America's global standing. The U.S. president also spoke out against the aggression of Russian President Vladimir Putin.
That's what every soldier, every Marine who stormed this beach has decided. A feared dictator had conquered a continent. They stood against Hitler's aggression. Does anyone doubt that they would want America to stand up against Putin's aggression here in Europe today? They stormed the beaches alongside their allies. Does anyone believe these Rangers would want America to go it alone today? Does anyone doubt they wouldn't move heaven and earth to vanquish hateful ideologies of today?
Also, while in France, Biden has publicly apologized to his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky, for the delay in American military aid being sent to the war-torn nation. FSN's Benji Hire reports.
I'm sorry. That's the message from Washington to Kyiv as both men sat down for talks in the French capital. I assure you the United States will stand with you, Biden told Zelensky. We are still in, completely. He promised a new raft of security assistance for Ukraine before delivering a speech on democracy and freedom from the site of the D-Day landings. Earlier this year, lawmakers in Congress passed a multi-billion dollar foreign aid package, but only after months of gridlock, during which Russia was able to make crucial battlefield advances.
Luxury vacations, Beyoncé tickets and a near $1 million book advance. Those are just some of the financial disclosures made by the U.S. Supreme Court justices. FSN's Tony Waterman has more.
For the first time, Justice Clarence Thomas acknowledged he went on two luxury vacations, one to Bali, the other to an exclusive club in California, all paid for by a conservative Texas billionaire. The story was first reported by ProPublica last year. In her disclosure, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said she received four concert tickets from Beyoncé and $10,000 worth of donated artwork. None of the other justices said they received gifts, but many reported royalties. Tony Waterman, Texas.
Prosecutors in the Hunter Biden trial have rested their case, handing over to the defense, which called their first witnesses to the stand on Friday afternoon. The trial revolves around gun charges, with Biden denying that he was using drugs when he bought a firearm in Delaware in 2018. The trial resumes on Monday. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
The Affordable Care Act, in place for nearly 15 years now, has survived repeal attempts, but there's renewed talk of reducing its funding. Later this year, Congress will have to agree on a new federal budget, and the Republican Study Committee proposes cuts to certain social programs, including the ACA. Chris Ostenzo owns an optometry clinic with her husband in northern Wisconsin and says at first premiums under the ACA were expensive, but recent caps ushered in through temporary tax credits have given her a lot more wiggle room.
When I realized I was going to be saving $1,000 a month on my health care premium, I basically just had the freedom to raise all my employees' salaries.
Her total savings are roughly $1,600 a month. The temporary caps only run through 2025, prompting separate calls for extensions. As for the current budget debate, Ostenzo worries people would lose coverage if the ACA sees cuts, resulting in skipped doctor's visits, worsening health outcomes. RSC members argue their blueprint has sensible policies to address the national debt. Ostenzo says the premium cap from recent ACA adjustments didn't just result in pay raises for her staff. It put them on a better path to obtaining health coverage themselves.
We always just had to encourage our employees to get health insurance and try to pay them enough to do it. And it really wasn't until the 8% that we succeeded in that. and they started all having health insurance.
Aside from premium cost factors, Ostenzo says a ban on denying coverage for those with pre-existing conditions helped her family when her daughter was battling cancer. Nowadays, she hopes other community members benefit from various provisions, including older adults who are near retirement age.
Maybe they'd want to retire a little early, mostly because they physically couldn't do their jobs anymore. And they would just tell me, well, I'm just going uninsured for these few years until I can qualify for Medicare. Well, those are the years of your life where you're going to start developing some bad health problems.
This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
Today, California air quality regulators are expected to adopt new fees for big polluters and rules to encourage large buildings to switch equipment from gas to zero-emission electric models. 15 clean air advocacy groups are rallying in front of the Southern California Air Quality Management Board in Diamond Bar today, urging passage of the new rules. Kimberly Orba with the Sierra Club says the transition would cover gas-fired water heaters, boilers, and process heaters.
Fossil fuel appliances are responsible for 10% of the emissions from stationary sources in our region, so that's really huge.
Opponents of the change include SoCalGas and industry groups representing dry cleaners and restaurateurs. When burned, natural gas emits harmful smog-forming air pollution and greenhouse gases that fuel climate change. The SoCal Air Quality Management District's new pollution fee program would require large industrial polluters to pay to support regional clean air efforts. The Sierra Club estimates this could raise about $25 million a year. According to the American Lung Association, the L.A. Long Beach area has the most high ozone days of any metropolitan area in the country. Orba says that's why advocacy groups have been pressing for stronger air quality standards for years.
Our region is burdened by an overwhelming amount of pollution from oil drilling, from refineries, from the ports, from the warehouses, freeways. So we want to make sure that we're passing strong rules to ensure that we continue to clean up our air year after year.
The board is also expected to set a hearing date to consider new rules requiring zero emissions technologies in the rail yards to combat diesel pollution from trains. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A group of environmental and civil society organizations is fighting for better working conditions for people in countries that supply critical minerals to the United States. Nickel, cobalt, lithium, and other minerals are mined and shipped to the U.S. for use in manufacturing electric vehicles, long storage batteries, microchips, and solar panels. Clayton Tucker is with the nonprofit Trade Justice Education Fund and says conditions in countries where the minerals are mined do not meet U.S. standards.
Mining cobalt, there's artisan mines, and child slavery is very, very commonly used. With nickel and Indonesia, the mine that you basically have to raise entire parts of the jungle and raise basically entire indigenous communities.
Almost 219,000 electric vehicles are registered in the state of Texas, and the Department of Transportation is working on infrastructure to increase the number of charging stations across the state. Several nonprofits in Texas recently received federal grant funding to install solar panels in low-income neighborhoods, increasing the number of households using the clean energy. Tucker and representatives from 38 other groups recently testified at a hearing with the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, calling for more stringent requirements for future critical mineral agreements between the U.S. and other countries. The only CMA that currently exists is between the United States and Japan. The U.S. Trade Representative says the agreement strengthens and diversifies critical minerals supply chains and promotes the adoption of electric vehicle battery technologies. But the environmental groups say the agreement doesn't go far enough to ensure that workers and the environment are protected and that it sets a concerning precedent. Tucker says the contracts come with certain perks and the U.S. needs to leverage its power.
Because we need these minerals. We're basically trying to make sure that, like, if you receive a subsidy, a tax credit, or any form of other support, that you play by our rules with climate protection, you play by our rules with labor protections.
The organizations want to be part of future CMA negotiations between the United States and other countries. I'm Frida Ross, Texas News Service.
And live in our KRFP studios, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Former State Senator Mary Souza of Coeur d'Alene says she will run for Idaho Republican Party chair at this month's Idaho Republican Party convention in an effort to wrest control of the party away from current chair Dorothy Moon, who has filled seats on the state party's central committee with her followers. Souza and Moon both ran for Secretary of State in 2022, losing the three-way Republican primary to current Secretary of State Phil McGrain. Moon, a far-right 2020 election denier who has a high rating from the influential anti-education group the Idaho Freedom Foundation, won the party chair position a month after losing the 2022 Secretary of State's primary, ousting then-Republican Party State Chair Tom Luna by a vote of 434 to 287. Moon is a former Idaho House member from Stanley, whose husband, Dar Moon, is on the John Birch Society National Council. In the legislative session before the 2022 Republican primary, Moon and Souza both introduced voter suppression bills in the legislature. During the 2022 session, Moon introduced numerous bills intent on overhauling Idaho elections, including voter suppression bills that would remove people's rights to use ballot drop boxes or sign an affidavit saying they are who they say they are on election day if they don't bring their ID to the polls, and one banning student photo IDs as an identification for voting or registering to vote. Souza also introduced similar bills that year. None of Moon's or Souza's voter suppression bills passed in 2022, although lawmakers later removed the citizens' right to use student photo IDs as identification while voting or registering to vote. While the Idaho Freedom Foundation endorsed Moon for Secretary of State in the May 2022 primary, Souza has been critical of the organization. She says both Moon and the Idaho Freedom Foundation have a reputation of never collaborating. Souza said in a statement yesterday she wants to end the current leadership on the State Republican Central Committee. She wrote in her announcement, "I want to get down to a little bit more of the brass tacks and how we can solve the situation that we found ourselves in because we didn't see it coming. It snuck up on us. I think with the extreme views that came into our party, unbeknownst to some of us, and we never thought it would take off. But you get enough people brought over to this way of thinking, and you will get a cult, and that's kind of what it's becoming." During her 2 years as party chair, Moon has implemented party platform hearings in which local Republican Party central committees, including the one in Latah County, decided to censure fellow Republican lawmakers for not adhering to the party platform when voting in the legislature. Souza called the hearings tribunals. According to the Idaho Press, she said, "Honestly, the current leadership in the Republican Party does not respect Republican voters. They want to tell them how to behave and how to vote, what to do, what not to do." The platform the central committees are trying to enforce skews far to the right. The platform, as party leadership adopted in 2022, says, "We affirm that abortion is murder from the moment of fertilization. All children should be protected regardless of the circumstances of conception, including persons conceived in rape and incest." The party platform also says those who want to vote in Republican primaries must affiliate with the party a full 1 year before the primary. However, that could not become state policy because Idaho Secretary of State Phil McGrain said last November he must follow state election law, and therefore anyone who officially affiliates with the Republican Party before the end of the candidate filing period in mid-March can vote in the Republican primary. Another Idaho Republican Party plank says all people who receive health care, quote, should be able to exercise free power of choice without intervention of any element of force, fraud, deceit, duress, overreaching, or other ulterior form of constraint or coercion. The platform also includes a new plank calling for the repeal of the 16th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which gives Congress the right to tax states. Another plank states the Republican Party is opposed to social justice being taught in public schools, calling it indoctrination. The teaching that falls under the party's category of social justice indoctrination includes critical race theory, transformative social-emotional learning, diversity, equity, inclusion, replacement theory, and queer theory. Idaho Republicans will meet at their state convention Thursday, June 13th through Saturday, June 15th in Coeur d'Alene, where they will vote on party leadership and perhaps amend the party platform. The Latah County Sheriff's Office is using a new technology to make gathering evidence and recording body camera footage easier for deputies. The body camera footage runs through a system called Polaris, made by the company Utility, which offers a central database for uploading and monitoring footage. Latah County received a five-year, $450,000 grant from the U.S. Justice Department to purchase video recording equipment from Utility, which is a digital systems company. The new technology includes new body camera devices, vehicle camera devices, a license plate reader, and a digital evidence collection system that's available to the public. The body camera can attach to a smartphone the deputy has in a pocket, and the deputy can activate it by tapping it or pressing a button. The body camera can activate automatically if it senses the deputy has fallen or is involved in a foot chase. It turns on automatically if the officer's vehicle is involved in a crash or when the deputy switches on red and blue lights and opens the car door. The new technology from Utility also includes a digital evidence collection system that should make evidence collection easier. Citizens can share video surveillance footage with law enforcement by uploading it to the sheriff's office through a website or a QR code that a deputy gives them. Captain Shane Anderson told the Lewiston Tribune Utility contacted the sheriff's office with the technology shortly after the investigation into the November 13, 2022 quadruple murders in Moscow began. All footage recorded by the deputy's body cameras or vehicle cameras would be immediately uploaded into the sheriff's office records. With their old system, deputies would have to spend time uploading the footage themselves at the police station. Anderson said the new technology will save them valuable time so they can spend more time protecting the public. Latah County Sheriff's Deputy Riley Harkins said the license plate reader would be mounted on the front of deputies' vehicles to record license plates of passing vehicles. It would alert officers to a stolen vehicle or a suspect's vehicle. Utility business manager John Joseph told the paper police can use the technology to send each other photos of suspects. The technology will automatically classify police footage based on what type of crime the deputy responded to and stores the video for the length of time that is required by Idaho law. The Bureau of Land Management has issued a final environmental review for the Lava Ridge Wind Farm near Minidoka in southern Idaho. After pushback from local residents and elected officials, the BLM scaled back the proposal from 400 wind turbines to 241 and limited their height to 660 feet. They also moved the project farther away from the Minidoka National Historic Site, which is where the U.S. government incarcerated about 10,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. The BLM final review says the smaller version of the project would reduce impacts on imperiled sage-grouse habitat and wildlife migration routes. Supporters of the project say it will create 700 construction jobs during the expected three-year build-out. There would be 20 permanent jobs maintaining the turbines. U.S. Senators Jim Risch and Mike Crapo of Idaho have spoken against the wind farm. Governor Brad Little said in a statement, "This is the latest example of the Biden administration's unsound energy agenda. The BLM is determined to give California electricity from Idaho, despite overwhelming opposition from Idaho and contrary to formal actions by Idaho's county, state, and federal elected officials, including federal legislation and federal law. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and Rembrandt Tree Care, family-owned and operated since 1977. A conscientious approach to urban forestry with year-round tree service on the Palouse and surrounding areas. You can reach Rembrandt Tree Care at 509-330-0699. KRFP is also sponsored by
Fiddler's Ridge Farm, a family-owned and operated plant nursery, serving the Palouse since 1992. Two locations to serve you, 2730 Highway 95 South in Moscow and 1001 Fiddler's Ridge Loop in Potlatch, 208-875-1003.
Residents who live near Foster Park in Clarkston staged a demonstration on Diagonal Street Wednesday, protesting that Foster Park is not a safe place for kids because of the homeless people living there. A recently passed city ordinance designates Foster Park as the only public space where camping is allowed within the city limits and then only between the hours of 9 p.m. and 7 a.m. The Lewiston Tribune reported 8 people were protesting and calling the homeless camping in the park voluntary homeless. One sign said, "Parks are for kids, not drugs." One person associated with the ad hoc group Foster Parks Advocates said a member used a metal detector and found drug paraphernalia and weapons at the park. It was not clear if they were using the metal detectors on people's tents or not. Protester Jennifer Graham told the paper, "We are just trying to show people more of what's going on. We feel like our rights are being ignored, and the rights of drug addicts and voluntary homeless people at the park are more important to the city." Graham said she and neighbors have been going to city council meetings to complain and calling police for 3 months. Before that, up to 75 people were living on a parcel near Walmart that was believed to be city land. When city officials learned the parcel was privately owned, police ordered the camp to disband, and the city passed the Foster Park ordinance. Susan Bishop, who lives in the area and uses a wheelchair, expressed frustration about the recent Northwest Justice Project court filing, asking a judge for a temporary restraining order against the city, preventing them from enforcing the ordinance that limits campers to Foster Park between the hours of 9 p.m. and 7 a.m. The filing says the city ordinance disproportionately impacts them because of their disabilities, which includes cancer, a seizure disorder, a tumor, post-traumatic stress disorder, and depression. Bishop said, "Basically, I'm stuck in my house because of people on the sidewalks. These people are trampling on the rights of the truly disabled. I'm not bashing the homeless. I'm talking about the criminals." Protester Jennifer Graham said the city should not only have one legal camping spot. Scott Darrington, who is homeless and a plaintiff in the lawsuit, said, "We don't want to be in Foster Park either, but we don't have anywhere else to go." Steve Bott, who said he often stays in the park, said there could be better solutions, such as using a vacant commercial building for a shelter. Bott said, "The people in this community should give a damn about all the people in their own community. Right now, it's a no-win situation. It's not a pick-and-choose side. Everyone needs to work together." The motion in the lawsuit includes an affidavit from homeless Foster Park resident John Park, which implied the limited hours for camping is stressing the homeless. Park wrote, "It gets dark long before 9 p.m. in the wintertime. You need shelter long before that. It means you have to wait until 9 p.m. to set up a tent, which means you can't even get to sleep until 10 p.m. or later, assuming you don't have trouble sleeping. Then you have to wake up at 6 a.m. to break it all down, again in the dark when it's freezing out." Idaho Fish and Game killed a black bear in Riggins after it approached and walked through the Big Water Blowout Concert and Dutch Oven Cook-Off during daylight hours Saturday. Fish and Game officials said because the bear showed no fear of people even after they hazed it, they shot the bear near Riggins City Park as people at the concert event looked on. Department employees first learned the bear was entering Riggins in early May, and it was eating trash that was not secured. A Fish and Game statement said at the time, "The bear continued to have access to trash and other foods and was increasingly showing signs that it was unafraid of people, even after several residents had fired warning shots in its vicinity." Fish and Game statement said of the shooting of the bear, "Fish and Game employees choose a career in wildlife management and conservation because they care deeply about wild animals, so the decision to euthanize animals is not one we take lightly. However, we must prioritize public safety, and given the unique circumstances of an agitated bear potentially heading toward a large crowd of people, the decision to kill the bear was the correct but unfortunate resolution. Killing this bear was an unfortunate last resort, but not nearly as tragic as if it had injured a human after we had an opportunity to stop it." Former Idaho Supreme Court Justice Daniel T. Eisenman died Tuesday night at the age of 77. Voters elected Eisenman to the state Supreme Court in 2000, and he stayed on the high court until he retired in 2017. For his last 10 years on the court, he was Chief Justice. A news release from the Idaho Judicial Branch said Eisenman was instrumental in creating the state's treatment court system, that he supported the interests of children who are caught up in court proceedings, and he was instrumental in setting up a task force of female judges to find ways to encourage more women to become state judges. After his appointment as an Owyhee County Magistrate Judge in 1986, Eisenman helped create Children's Voices Incorporated to recruit, train, and oversee what the courts call guardians ad litem, who represent the interests of neglected and abused children in court proceedings. An Idaho Press obituary says Eisenman organized a community diversion board to handle first-time juvenile offenders involved in minor cases outside the court system. After he was appointed as an Ada County District Judge in 1995, Eisenman set up the first drug court in Idaho. The court became functional in 1999, the year before his election to the state Supreme Court. Current Idaho Supreme Court Chief Justice Richard Bevin released a statement Wednesday which said, "Justice Eisenman was a towering figure in the law who exemplified the highest standards of judicial excellence and unwavering commitment to justice throughout his distinguished career. He will be remembered for his significant contributions to the law and the profound influence he had on all who had the privilege of associating with him."
KRFP thanks its listeners and supporters, including the Palouse Folklore Society, celebrating traditional music and dance on the Palouse since 1982. The Palouse Folklore Society sponsors concerts, jam sessions, and a monthly contra dance. Find out more at palousefolk.org or on Facebook.
You're tuned to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman. The Moscow City Council wants staff and the hired firm Design West Architects to get as much public input as possible before committing to changing the location and orientation of the East City Park stage. The city needs to replace the 40-year-old Peter Bessoa stage in the park, which is used for Renaissance Fair, Hemp Fest, and other concerts and performances, but not by Rendezvous in the Park, which since the 1990s has installed temporary stages in the southeast quadrant of the park for their multi-day annual music festival in July. The stage deteriorated quicker than anticipated, and during routine maintenance this spring, it became clear the stage awning would need to be removed immediately to ensure public safety. Main stage music at this year's Renaissance Fair was performed under a canopy on the old stage. Replacing the stage was part of the 2010 master plan for the park, of which phase one was building new restrooms, which has already happened. At Monday night's city council meeting, architect Ned Warnick of the Pullman firm Design West Architects told how the 2010 master plan called for placing the new stage with its back towards the new restrooms and with performers facing northeast instead of due west. Here's that presentation plus discussion from the city council at Monday night's city council meeting. This lasts just over 35 minutes.
As you'll recall, we brought you this item in a very abbreviated format early May. At that time, council did approve a professional services agreement between the city and Design West Architects. That approval was to expand upon a project that was approved or developed at least conceptually a number of years ago, and to take that and advance it to a 30% conceptual design with cost estimate that'll help inform future budget and capital planning efforts. It was clear at that time, though, we could have provided a little bit more in the way of context and background that kind of what led us to that point. So that's really what we're here for today. It's not an action item, but again, is to provide a little better background information for you. It's wonderful that Ned Warnick with Design West Architects, who was actually involved or managed the project from a design standpoint years ago, is going to join us and kind of walk you through some of the background on the design and what led to the concept as it sits today. Once he wraps up, I'll kind of walk through some ideas we have or that we'd like to take on in terms of public outreach, just to get the message back out, because again, it has been a number of years since we went through the initial exercise. So with that, I'll turn things over to Ned.
Welcome, Ned.
Thank you. I think what Cody means in the wonderful is that I'm still alive and kicking to be able to be here before you. I have to say that when Bill and Cody reached out to me about this opportunity, I was thrilled. This was a great project that was not realized to its full extent at the time that we started the process. And so to have this opportunity to revisit and discuss it and to get council input on where we were at and what our thoughts were, I think this is a wonderful opportunity. And so I hope to give you a little bit of background on what happened 14 years ago. And how we progress to the point we're at, and then be able to hear what the council has to say about those things. And so as a quick introduction, in 2010, just almost exactly 14 years ago, we were engaged to enter into a planning and design process to replace the existing restrooms and stage at the East City Park. And I will tell you that you got 14 more years of use out of the volunteer-built stage than we ever thought you would get. At the time, that stage was in pretty rough shape, and for it to have made it all the way to now is pretty impressive. But that process that we went through in August and September of 2010 was intensive and extensive. The intensive work with the stakeholders of trying to understand what the needs were for different performances that happen at the park, and extensive in the sense that there was a lot of outreach involved with the Saturday market and other opportunities in the city, in City Hall and at the Hamilton Low Rec Center. As it unwound, or as time went by, the city was unable to arrive at the funds to be able to approach what the estimated cost of the project was at that time. And the restrooms were deteriorating faster than what the stage was. And so the original restrooms, or the existing restrooms at that time, needed to come down in 2012. And so at that point, the decision was made to phase the project. Originally, it was envisioned as a restroom and a stage together, and in 2012, the decision was to split the project and go ahead and get the new restrooms built. I'll cycle back to that a little bit later in this presentation, but to talk about the stakeholders, one of the things that was really enjoyable about my experience of working with the different people that were involved in this, and Renfair was represented there, as was Rendezvous in the Park and a number of the other major players. But to many of us, we might think a stage is a stage. Now, let's just get a platform up there and everything's going to be great. And then when you talk to these people, every one of them has their own ideas of what that stage will do. So you have speakers, you have presentations, you have award ceremonies, you have poetry readings, you have chamber music, you You have jazz ensembles. You have drama productions, all of those things. And all of them have a very different approach to what they want that stage to be, from stage height to stage height off the ground to stage height to the cover to the sort of amenities that that stage will have. And it was a wonderful experience going through three stakeholder work sessions with these groups, because there was a real genuine desire to arrive at a good stage that would work for everybody. And so there was compromise and collaboration throughout all these different groups. Working through, I do want to point out, this has been really fun to prepare for this presentation, because I came across a picture of myself standing in almost this exact same location. And I went home and I told my wife about it, and she said, I bet you were wearing earth tones. Mm-hmm. And she was right. But I digress. So some of the main conclusions that we came out of the process, and all this is not just the bullet points that are there. There was not any expectation that we would try to arrive at a stage that would work for Rendezvous in the Park's biggest acts. And so that was an early thought. We thought originally that the stage would end up down towards the south from where the restrooms are, more in the arrangement of how the Rendezvous in the Park arranges the park. And really it came to the conclusion that an extra large Rendezvous in the Park stage wouldn't work for most of the uses of the stage in the park. And so that was kind of a conclusion coming out of the early work sessions. And we worked our way around to a small stage or a medium-sized stage is a good thing. A medium-sized stage in the center of the park, where it works most flexibly for the different events that happen in the park and is farthest away from the street noise, is a positive thing. And fine-tuning how it addresses the topography of the park was a good thing. And so all of those things related to arriving at a master plan that...
Can you just go back?
Sure.
Can I just interrupt? I already did, but I just want to point out that Arlene is in that picture too.
And she's also in the audience today. Good eye, sorry. Julia.
Almost in the exact same arrangements.
Let's get a picture of this.
Yeah. All right. I just wanted Good to eye. Point that out, Arlene. Thank you. I recognize the shirt.
And so the master plan arrived at you can see the dashed line of what the original restrooms and stage were located in the very much in the very center of the park. And the original stage had problems with big trees in front of it facing straight west, so performers had sun in their eyes. And really, it worked for very small gatherings with the slope, but if you got very large crowds, you were kind of over the crown of the hill or back in the bushes. And so the rotation around to being more at an angle to the northwest for the stage and facing uphill worked better for the topography, so we end up having more of an amphitheater sort of effect. And 14 years ago, I actually had kids that still played in the playground, and I would always be frustrated when I'd come to a performance and that I either had to decide to be a good parent or watch the performance. And, you know, it was a coin flip depending on what I did that day. But in this arrangement, the playground and the expanded playground that's happened at the kind of the crown of the hill is available to kids, but at the same time, parents can keep an eye on the performance and the kids at the same time. And so that was a major positive. The other thing is that by moving the stage a little bit to the southeast, we opened up what we affectionately call the Dancer's Plaza. And so the kind of mud pit or the muddy front of stage condition is something that we want to address with this project, with something that is more of an all-weather surface that would allow a level dancing area, but also one that doesn't turn into mud when we have a Ren Fair, for example, which... for all the right reasons, happens in the spring when sometimes the weather doesn't cooperate. And so that's the background on what the arrangement or the kind of the master plan of how this fits into the overall East City Park area. The floor plan to the right is what we envisioned when we originally started the project, where it would be one combined arrangement. And as the budget constraints set in and we moved into 2012, we looked for a more compact restroom arrangement and a way for us to at least start down the road of moving towards this stage. And so the existing restroom that is there now is a result of that. And so in my mind, I think of that as phase one. We just taking our time to get to phase two, but I understand it's time that we should revisit that. I had a to me, it was a humorous conversation with Cody, was, well, gosh, I need to drive by and make sure there hasn't been a tree that grew up in the wrong place that would undermine this. And I would say, in looking at the park today, I can easily envision this being built out the way that it was envisioned. I think that the park has evolved in the way that we expected. The large trees, we won't be taking down any of those, and the open amphitheater space is there and available for us to develop this. The stage changes shape a little bit to reflect the arrangement of the first phase restroom, but the size, the heights, the features and the support spaces are all the same as what we imagined back in 2010. Some of the, and this is a little bit out of date because the restroom block is now a little bit bigger, and actually the roof slopes the opposite direction from what it does in option A. But this is a fun exercise for me in my hometown, is to have this up at Saturday Market and have this be voted upon. And so you get actual crowdsourcing of design input, as opposed to you talk to a few clients, you do something, and then it turns out that nobody likes it. Here's something where we had a chance to really roll this out to the Saturday Market crowd. And so these three options were provided Saturday Market. The first one we affectionately called the piano. The second one was just the barrel arch. And the third one was the gable. And so those were provided to Saturday Markets, I think, two or three times, along with council chambers. And I would guess it's a resounding victory. The majority vote was option B, which was the barrel vault. And that is still an option that can be explored in this dusting off and moving into phase two. There's a few quotes from some of the outreach efforts that we did back in 2010. And that, it reinforced that the work that we had done with the stakeholder group, I think people felt like we were making good decisions, and it would end up being the kind of stage that would help expand the use of the park.
Yeah. So in terms of next steps, we do, a lot of work did go into this, but again, it was 14 years ago. Other than Ned and a couple folks in the room, you know, the public deserve to know what we're up to. So along with updating the conceptual design, we want to go through an outreach process this summer that would include leveraging the audience we have right there at the farmer's market. We could have another open house at City Hall where we could solicit feedback. Again, building on the work that's already been done, not starting from scratch, looking at a new site layout, but building on the work that had already been done. We'd like to explore having a display at something like Rendezvous in the Park or anything at the park itself, where people are on site and can actually visualize it with display boards, things like that. Series of stakeholder meetings with some of the people that host specific events at the park and know it better than a lot of us. And then certainly leverage our website as an opportunity for additional outreach. So again, we have a professional services agreement approved with Design West Architects. Again, that's to build upon previous design and outreach effort. That'll culminate later this summer in a 30% conceptual design and cost estimate. Nothing beyond that. We're not authorizing construction with that agreement, but really to help us inform future budget and capital improvement planning. Any additional expenses related, that would certainly have to come back to you for approval. So I think that's what we wanted to walk you through today. We're both available for any questions you might have, and happy to help.
I just want to say thank you for walking us through that. It was helpful because it's been so long since we did the public outreach. It's good to have the reminders about what all was done. And yeah, I just wanted to say thank you.
You can ask. Right. Yeah. Thank you, Ned, for the presentation, and thank you, Cody, for making this happen again. This is very helpful to build on from what we discussed back in May. So I'm happy to have more input and more intel. I'm sure all of my colleagues have received a handful of emails of people that are definitely out in the community that are reluctant, to say the least, about having the stage moved for a variety of reasons. So I'm curious, from either the city perspective or Ned, if you want to weigh in as well. What are some replies or what are some things that we can tell concerned community members that ask, well, what if we just kind of rebuilt a nice stage in the current location of the current stage, as opposed to moving it to that slight northwest, moving it slightly to the northwest. So I'm curious, like what replies would you encourage us or to consider or offer to some of those concerned community members?
I'd love to take a crack at it. I actually, Ned's probably spent a lot more time on site than I have. Mm-hmm. But I spent a lot of time out there on site. And I think you can see in the new location, just the orientation as trees have matured over the years and the space that's available with that natural topography. We can accommodate a lot more seating, a lot more flexibility. The existing stage as it sits today, you know, you have two or three trees that are blocking, gosh, a third of the vision to the actual performances. And I've had the unfortunate experience of, you know, enough of a crowd that I'm sitting over there. So that's kind of difficult. I think if you really sit on site, you can see just how, what led to the design that Ned worked on years ago.
And I did walk through East City last week and try to do some visualization as well and prep for tonight and just kind of getting some feedback from community members as well and kind of like visualizing that as well and thinking, well, again, I'm sure that we could all kind of have these like little what if moments of what if we just moved it back 10 feet, but still in the same orientation that it's been in. Right. So it still has that homage to years past and homage to folks that have put blood, sweat, and tears on that stage of the community that would be really reluctant to see it just ripped up and moved over to the northwest. But I appreciate the kind of refocus on the orientation, but I do think that their concerns, you know, are definitely not without merit, right? But I appreciate your response. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this helps some. I am still left with more questions than anything. I'm still really, really hesitant because this is helpful for me. I've scribbled very concerned with total vote participation for these. If what we're asking for input on were these three profiles and now there is a conversation, I still feel like there should be an option for public input for there to replace the state footprint where it is and not move it, because the questions that come to mind are like, is it Answer Plaza going to be grass or paved? Are we going to have to pave more things? Are trees going to have to come down? Are we going to have to pave more for load in and load out? Are we going to have to move the path location? And are we going to just have a longer outage for East City Park for this when we could potentially be looking at a quote for just replacing the stage where it is, in addition to honoring the historic homage of all of our community members who gave blood, sweat, and tears to build this when it was a community-led thing. I'm really glad we're seeing more engagement. Mm-hmm. I'm really concerned that what I'm understanding is what we sourced from even 100 votes. And I think you'll have a much better feedback at whatever farmers market we table at this time around, which will be cool to see, is that we were asking for input on the profile and not on moving the stage. Like, I'm really concerned that the general public outside of those stakeholders, what I'm hearing is, yes, I would love some additional clarification, because what I'm hearing and what I'm hearing from the community who are looking at these meeting minutes and things like that was that the public point of input for the general public outside of those key stakeholders was just like what the silhouette
was going
to be. I
agree. I think those are two separate issues. The aesthetic decision of what shape this stage takes is the second question that needs to be answered. The first question needs to be answered is the decision that was reached in 2010 about moving the stage? And I would be curious from your perspective in terms of the input of people who are saying, I want to keep the stage where it's at. Are those people performers? Are those people that...
Yes.
And that is odd to me, because that was not the result of the 2010. And there was a lot of discussion about the orientation being difficult for crowd because of the two large trees that obstruct the view and ruin the audience experience, and that you don't have an array of audience that you can make connection with, and also busts up any ability of that you have for understanding what mm-hmm. your acoustics are doing out in that space. And then the other is the complaints of the West Sun, and that if you are performing on the wrong day at sunset, you aren't seeing anything at all because of that West orientation.
And I guess we've had 15 years of tree growth, so I'm curious about that. And the other thing I'll add, so on my way here, I stopped by the rendezvous board meeting. I was on the board for 12 years. I can't speak for the board now. I am a recovering boardie. you could say. And I mean, it's been one day since I've been to a meeting for Rendezvous. Times have changed. I had a good conversation with Bill Boxman, who helped form Rendezvous back when it was still under the city umbrella. And anymore, the contracts for the artists, even when I was helping a few years ago secure artist contracts, they will require a 4-foot tall stage. And nearly no other event in Moscow will have that same sort of need. So Rendezvous is not really your ideal client for this. They are still happy to play nice. Rendezvous for Kids still uses it. But my concerns stem from what that also impacts as far as load in, load out for other. It was good to hear that from Rendezvous. They're happy to, you know, give more input, but I'm concerned that enough things have changed in 15 years since we got here. And I still have a really hard time understanding what 30% gets me, because I would still love to know what 30% of copy paste existing footprint would be, because my understanding from Bill and Cody is that's still going to be as much money as it's going to cost us to shift it. But there's a lot of unknowns. I'm glad 30% gets us some more community input, but I'm thinking that the silhouette, you boiled it down perfectly, Ned. Like, the silhouette is a question, but I am more concerned that we are getting enough input from the community who have adjusted to having the bathroom and stage as separate things, that moving the stage is now the hotter topic.
You're listening to Moscow City Council discussion of a plan to build a new East City Park stage for performances. The discussion includes a presentation from Deputy City Supervisor Cody Riddle and architect Ned Warnick of the Pullman firm Design West. You'll also hear from City Council members Haley Lewis, Gina Parker, Julia Parker, Sandra Kelly, Bryce Blankenship, and Drew Davis, as well as Mayor Art Bedke. The discussion was recorded at Monday night's City Council meeting. We'll be back with the conclusion of the discussion in a moment. You're tuned to the KRFP Evening Report.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored in part by Hunga Dunga Brewing Company of 333 North Jackson Street in Moscow. Hunga Dunga features live music, special events, fine food, and craft beers. At hungadungabrewing.com and on Facebook and Instagram.
KRFP supports progressive values, including multiculturalism and environmentalism.
We now have the conclusion of Monday night's Moscow City Council discussion of a plan to build a new East City Park stage for performances.
Hold on, Gina.
So I come from the performance angle, right? And I do hang around. I mean, East City Park is kind of it's one of the holy grails of being able to perform, right? I mean, because it's right in the middle of where we all live, right? And you are completely correct that if you're there on the wrong night, you are bleeding and you're sweating and you are wishing you weren't. And it
write
is
a song about that.
I might write a song about that once my retinas recover. I do think that it is important at this point to, exactly like you're saying, Ned, separate the two questions, but you've got to get answers to both of them. And I think that 15 years, like Haley said, a lot has changed, including trees. And growing up, and maybe we don't have retinal damage when we stand at the microphone anymore. And so I think this is one of these opportunities for the city now to capitalize on opportunities for the community to weigh in and leave that darn website open until it is smoking from so many people bringing in their thoughts, right? And make sure we're at these events, because this is the moment. And 30%, all right, you know, it 30% of kind of this idea right now gets us closer, but no, this is no decision-making moment. We just need to identify the questions, answer them, and move on as a community. So
I will say, I mean, that's great. I will follow your lead. The hesitancy I would have is that, at least from my experience, 2010, is I think the answer that we would have gotten without having the collaborative work sessions of the multiple different performers together wouldn't be as good as what we got. And I agree, it may have changed, but for us to solicit input from the Saturday market, I joke that, you know, it's great that we got public input on the aesthetic side of this. Yeah. But what I, being involved in those three stakeholder sessions and working through the different, well, what's the sweet spot in size? We can't afford to have a rendezvous in the park stage over there. We don't want a 4-foot tall platform for kids rendezvous in the park or a Ren Faire performance or any of those things. And so we dialed that stage up and down. We rotated around. And so my concern is that without at least respecting that baby that's in the bathwater, I'm nervous about the idea of let's throw that baby out and let's start over again and not have that same sort of guided master planning process.
Do we have to throw it out?
I don't know. I'm trying to understand. I would be really curious.
I don't think we should. I think it's one of the options.
Hold on. So
I think that we respect, like we're all saying, get homage to everything, right? So one of the options is moving it. One of the options is not moving it. You know, and then everybody can weigh in and still respect the work that you did. This is one counselor. I am merely throwing out Gina's ideas.
Do you have a vision as to how that question would be posed to what groups?
Well, now you're way above my pay grade, Ned. I do not know that answer. What I can say is if we don't ask it, it's going to be more damaging than if we do.
Correct.
So, Drew.
One comment before I ask my real question. Ned taught my professional practice class in college, and so I am a little intimidated.
I did
review all my notes, Ned, before you came, though, just to make sure everything was kosher. I will say in reviewing those notes, going back from 2013, the one thing that you did bring up, and I know I'm going back, but there's a point to the story, is in the class you talk about engaging with the public, how that's a critical process, but also how it's extremely difficult process, because no matter what you do to engage with the public, there's always going to be a part of that Indeed. Pie that is always going to be upset, no matter how you go about that. And so your methods that you spoke about, that you exhibited in 2010, right, during this time, till now, is you can only do so much with what people give you, right? And no matter what people give you, you're going to. And I know you know this. I'm regurgitating what you told me. And some I still use today, right? And that process is hard. And from this perspective, it's even more difficult. Because there's going to be people upset. The concerns and questions that I have are, I think you've talked about them. You're going to talk about them at further lengths, engaging the public. But questions I want to pose to the public and to everyone that sits behind this bench, that I all respect your opinions deeply, is, let's say the current location of the stage, we spend X amount of dollars. We're not going to go into how much it costs to reconstruct that. This happened 40 years ago. Are we looking at what the next 40 years of the stage are going to be for our community? How are they going to be different and how have they changed? This stage needs to last more than 40 years for the public. And as trees, as landscape, all these things change, we need to think about that. And the reality is, I don't know what the key to success is, but the key to failure is trying to please everybody in this process.
Great.
And the decision of moving this, and I'm really thankful. Last week I had the opportunity to be in three people's homes. They kindly invited me into their homes to talk about this. I was more than happy to do that. Their hospitality was fantastic, and we had a fantastic. Two of them are here in the crowd today, where I came over and spoke with them. And the idea and the location of the stage does not tread on, we're not grateful for the efforts that were done for 40 years ago. Quite frankly, they are a catalyst for culture in our community. This new location is only to enhance that. And the question that I pose that we don't need answers to, but what other programs or what other end users could be using the stage that aren't currently using it because of locations and its limitations? And we have to judge that based on time. And that is an extremely difficult thing, as Ned can attest to. How do you design for the future and how do you embrace the past? Mm-hmm. And as we move forward, I would like this to be 100 years. They're going to open up the meeting notes and they're like, who was that guy on council named Drew that thought? Like, if that's the conversation, that's where it's going to go, right? But we're going to design this for longer than 40 years, and we're designing it to address the extremely growing needs of a community that love art and need to support that at a much larger scale than what we're going to. And they're hard decisions, and all the people I've talked to, receive emails to, communicate with, I thank you, and I continue to invite you to give feedback. But I hope that how we view this is an open-minded approach for what the future will be. Because in 100 years, I'm not going to be here. Not, to be honest, probably none of us are going to be here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I invite you to say, how does this help our community for the long run while still respecting what's done in the past? And that was addressed through community outreach. And I commend you for doing that and walking us through that. So thank you. And thank you for your pro practice class in 2013.
Haley, back to you.
My questions were never to imply that I'm not open to this. I'm feeling a lot of feelings. My therapist would tell me to name them and I don't even know where to start. I'm driven by frugality. I'm driven by being scrappy. And again, the reason I keep banging the drum about not moving the stage is because I still don't even understand what it looks like for us to not move the stage. I feel like I don't have a big enough picture to be excited about moving it. And so that being the penny pincher I am driven by understanding if with public engagement, which is very hard. And I know I will never make everyone happy. And I can hardly make myself happy, both sides of myself happy in a day. I want to understand what not moving it would look like in terms of finances, in terms of if our community is happy with that or not. And so Gina, I think what you were able to verbalize after I ran down all my list of big question marks about the Dancers Plaza and the grass and the trees and the path and whatever. Yeah, eye to the future. Those things can be uncomfortable for a couple of years and we may be better for it if we move the stage. But I just want to understand if I can appease a number of people, if the majority of people are happy with us not moving the stage by copy-pasting, putting it where it is, keeping them as two separate buildings, and understanding what the cost is. And I don't know what 30% will get me in terms of those numbers, because my sense is that 30% will give us updated numbers with the shift to the Northwest. So,
Mr. Mayor.
I think it's
always going to hit Ned about the finance issue, perhaps.
Within our professional services contract, I think it is reasonable for us to array those options before you.
Love it.
What I will say is that with both of them, there is a spectrum as to what we can do. So your question about the Dancers Plaza, that's going to have a dollar figure associated with it. And so if you want that, I'll say that's the price tag. It's got $25,000 attached to it. The size of the stage and the question of where it lands, I think we can give you some feedback, or I can give city staff that sort of feedback, and we can tell you that. I would love to go back through the same experience. I hope Arlene will show up again. We can do it all again. But that is a lot more intensive. Your request is a reasonable one, and within a 30% design effort, asking what does it cost here versus what does it cost here, that's included in that.
Great.
And so we can provide you that sort of feedback. I will be excited to hear the feedback as that comes back, because we did not have a lot of sentimental attachment to the old stage 14 years ago. And maybe it managed to cross the historic preservation mark, but if it was only 40 years ago, it didn't. So, but there was not a lot of hesitancy 14 years ago. But your request is reasonable, and I'm perfectly happy. That can be something that we include in our analysis.
Ian, I can't tell if now as it's falling apart that if that's what's made it sentimental for us. I've always been fairly sentimental for it, but I remember how awful those bathrooms were before the arson case happened. Like, I mean, I remember. To your earlier comment, Ned, like I think I get the fear of rehashing or starting from square one with public input can be messy. There are new stakeholders like the Earth Day folks, and there are a couple other, you know, new festivals that I'd be curious to hear as newer users to the park would think about these things. But I guess, yeah, what I am most interested in learning from the public is, do you want to move the stage or not? Because I am overwhelmingly what I have heard, granted bias from who is willing to reach out to me, are people who are not stoked on it. So I'm curious.
Julia.
Haley, can you let me talk now? Thank you. All right. I have a couple of things. One is that I do think we respectfully need to move forward in Moscow. And sometimes that is super hard. And people don't want things to change because we live in a great community. And I understand that. I don't love change either. But I think there are real concrete reasons for us to move the stage. And that is that we can allow for better seating, more seating, that the view of the stage isn't blocked by large old trees, that we won't, as I understand it, we won't need to cut down any of the older trees in the park if we reorient the stage. Whereas if we build a bigger stage right there, we would run into some big trees. And so I understand that people have feelings about the stage. And I saw, you know, my little girl up there doing ballet on that old stage too. And, it, you know, it, I have nostalgia for it. And I've been to a lot of events there, of course, with my kids and through the years. But the reality is we're growing, we're changing, our arts community is growing, and we need to provide them with a stage that's appropriate for them and a place for people to engage in the arts performances that's big enough for our population. And so I know that people have a lot of feelings about this, but I think there's real concrete, no pun intended, reasons to adjust East City Park and make it something usable for everyone. And so I would love to figure out some way to be respectful of the work that people did 40 years ago. I count many of them among my friends, and figure out a way to honor that by using the stage, using the wood, doing something, you know, to honor that.
But, that's a good idea.
But I really think that this is a change that is necessary. And so I understand we want to get a lot of public input. But when there's real concrete issues to just keeping things the same or rebuilding in the same spot, then we have to give voice to those things as well. So I'm just trying to understand Moscow. You know, we like our town, we like things the same, but I think this change in the stage was designed this way for a reason 14 years ago, and those reasons haven't changed.
Gina.
I think that I'm a big fan of community input. I am not a fan of community input until you are a bloody pulp on the ground. What I think is important is this 30% moment. Is this 30% moment of here's what we envisioned X amount of years ago and what it can bring. And I'm a huge fan of moving it because retinas. Okay. I think it will be illuminating. Again, at that 30 and concrete and illuminating, this 30% again, moment will be huge. Will be huge. So I appreciate that you are willing to give us both of the options and kind of to understand that.
And I just to clarify, 30% yes. is we're 30% on the way to somewhere. There's right. a lot of things that happen between 0 and 30%. And so this background of trying to give you the idea of what has gone on before is not to say it's going to be cut and paste. There's work that goes into that process. And I am intrigued because there's clearly some level of groundswell out there about what does it mean to keep something closer to what was original. And having listened to Alyssa's budget woes, I can tell you that I went through the exact same thing through the last 2 or 3 years on many projects. And I think we need to be able to talk to city staff about an array of options as we move towards this is the 30% that we get to after I do all my work.
Right.
So anyway, to wrap up, because we've gotten kind of circular,
yeah.
is to sort of provide the direction to make the effort to get more community outreach done, get some more input from community, and then as part of a 30%, get a financial comparison between reconstruct where it is versus reconstructing the new and have some kind of a more or less, certainly not exact, but just a ballpark estimate of who's going to cost how much. They might be the same, in which case then we're back down to the decision based on community input. So that's kind of how I see things from where I was sitting, more or less.
We move to accept the report?
Yeah. So that's it.
Yep.
So.
That was Moscow Mayor Art Bedke. You've been listening to a Moscow City Council discussion from Monday on a plan to build the new East City Park stage for performances. The Moscow City Council wants staff and the hired firm Design West Architects to get as much public input as possible before committing to changing the location and orientation of the East City Park stage. The city needs to replace the 40-year-old Peter Bessoa stage in the park, which is used for Renaissance Fair, Hemp Fest, and other concerts and performances, but not by Rendezvous in the Park, which since the 1990s has installed temporary stages in the southeast quadrant of the park for their multi-day annual music festival, which is held in July. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, it'll be clear through tomorrow, partly cloudy Saturday night and Sunday, low 55, high 76, 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms before midnight Sunday night, otherwise partly cloudy, low 53, and clear skies Monday through Thursday of next week, with highs 78 Monday and Tuesday, 71 Wednesday and 74 Thursday, lows 51 Monday night, and 47 Tuesday and Wednesday night. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. And once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
KRFP thanks its donors and sponsors, including Hodgins Drug and Hobbies of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hodgins features a pharmacy,
educational toys, and hobbies. Hodgins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hodgins at 208-882-5536. KRFP is also sponsored by
Fiddler's Ridge Farm, a family-owned and operated plant nursery serving the Palouse since 1992. Two locations to serve you, 2730 Highway 95 South in Moscow and 1001 Fiddler's Ridge Loop in Potlatch. 208-875-1003.